you didn't work on trust and relationship in the past and the kind of parameters about here's how we work together, there's no time like now to start, to think about it and be conscious of it.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen. I'm today joined by Liz Kislick, and it's really a joy to have her in this conversation today. Liz is a management consultant and executive coach, has been authoring quite a number of works, either in Harvard Business Review or in Forbes. She also has an amazing TED Talk with more than 300,000 views by now. Amazing. And it's all about why there's so much conflict at work and what can you do to fix it. Liz, thanks for taking your time and joining us today.
Well, I'm so happy to be with you.
So we have a number of questions actually prepared for you, Liz, to kind of really talk through and have that conversation and to see how coaches and leaders can use that in working with their teams and also working with themselves, obviously, right? So we're in a very funny season at the moment in the world of business. A lot of remote teams, which are kind of here to stay, geographically dispersed, online. And some of it is maybe because of COVID season, but also there's other kind of trends that really has been driving this already for years. This is just an acceleration and here to stay. So what can we do, Liz, to engage people better?
I think the first thing, Will, is to actually pay attention to them.
Mm-hmm.
To pay attention to them as the individual human beings they are,
mm-hmm.
to get away from the idea of the workforce,
mm-hmm.
and to think about the actual employees.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very hard to be engaged if you don't actually believe that someone cares about you.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point about remote work, and I think there will be a lot of hybrid situations,
mm-hmm.
which is even more challenging whenever you mix it up. It becomes more challenging. I think we have to pay attention to our people and actually be in touch with them in specific, concrete ways,
mm-hmm.
so that they recognize that we know who they are. They are not anonymous. They are not just part of a mass,
mm-hmm.
and that leaders actually care enough to check in with them with frequency. I don't know what you see, but a couple of years ago, at many companies, leaders often did not meet one-on-one with their people more than once a month.
Mm-hmm.
That's unacceptable now. You won't know what's happening with people. They won't understand what they really need to be dealing with, setting as their priorities, emphasizing, and people can start to feel lost and sort of fall off the edges,
mm-hmm.
settle down to a kind of boring, inert, unexciting, what does it matter what I do? Nobody really cares about me.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is actually leadership presence and attention.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. You mentioned the word care a lot over the last couple of minutes, right?
Yeah.
And two questions kind of come up. So why does care matter more now than a few years ago? And the other part is caring for people is really a customized business, right? Part of what you're saying is everybody wants to be cared for in their way. So leadership becomes a much more of a customized business more than ever before. So yeah, these two things, is why is it different than a couple of years ago? And how does that customization really have become so much more different or important?
Good. You'll remind me if I forget the second question. So the first question, I don't think care is actually more important. I think it was always important. But I think leaders could get away with not being as personally attached and personally available. I think our expectations as working people of what the workplace demanded from us, what we had to give, I think many people thought they were stuck and they just had to put up with not feeling good at work.
Mm-hmm.
I think the human need for care and attention is ever present. The difference is that in this period, we've really seen how much it matters. We've really seen how people suffer when they feel detached from their community, their workplace, when they feel alone with hard things, and that workplaces where leaders are engaged and are paying attention and are seeking out their team members and being more personal than they perhaps used to be, that they get better results. So I think the empirical evidence is that when you show you care, your workforce responds. So I don't think it's different, but I think this has been such a difficult, challenging time all around the world in all kinds of different ways. And I think workers, even at the executive level, see how much better it feels when you feel a sense of community at work. As opposed to work being the place where you had to deliver on certain things and you got all your gratification and ego satisfaction outside of work. Well, when you're working from home, as was the case with many, many white collar workers, that is your community. We weren't going out and seeing people. So sometimes the Zoom was the only place you saw people. That kind of connection has become more important and people feel more strongly about it being done well. So that takes us to the second part, if I recall correctly, about the kind and the nature of caring and how do you actually show it. And so on the one hand, in a kind of quantitative way, if you go by the old premise that what gets measured gets done, then spending actual time, putting time in the calendar for talking to people, for seeing how they are. But it doesn't all have to be face-to-face. It doesn't have to be Zoom. Lovely notes can work too. But actually checking in with employees about how they're doing on their work and their projects, but also how their health is, how the health of their loved ones is, what's going on at home. Those kinds of markers of actual concern for the human being go a long way.
Yeah, that's a great segue into the next part of that question. So you were saying that creating more personal bonds at work also helps people to deal with stress and burnout or manage stress and burnout. So tell us a little bit more about that and how that really strengthens that one-on-one relationship. Because it seems to be it's a very mutual interactive impact.
So at the beginning of the pandemic, when certainly I was doing a lot more Zooms, I'm sure you were too, do you remember how it was actually wonderful to see people you hadn't seen? It was this strange mix of regular happiness and a kind of relief almost that they were still all right, that they were still there. I think the issue of burnout, there's been a lot of burden. There's been the burden of care for loved ones, care about our own health. Anxiety levels have risen. People aren't feeling strong in many cases, and it has been so different for different people. At the beginning of the pandemic, there were some people who, as a kind of coping mechanism, worked all the time, were more productive than they had ever been, and other people who withdrew. And then some of the people who came on so strong out of the gate later on started to feel a little detached or less engaged or burning out from just working all the time, not having the limits of leaving work and going home. And so therefore not having that kind of differentiation in their own minds, they were always on. one of the things that's very helpful going through this is if the leader explains what's expected, what we'd like to see from you, but also what's okay. We understand if, say, during all our Zooms, if you have things going on in the background and it's inconvenient for you, turn your camera off for a while so that you don't have to feel distressed and self-conscious, and you can really focus on talking with us. That's one kind of thing. A second thing is letting people have more control over their working time, over their schedules. If they can deliver, let them call that shot. Being very conscious of making sure that people take vacation, that they are not sending emails at all hours. And leaders have to model this behavior. So the fact that the leader may have a brilliant thought at 11 o'clock at night, so write the email, but schedule it for work hours. Don't send it right away just because you're excited, because someone else who's up may feel obligated to answer. Help them maintain boundaries. Leaders can talk about how they're spending time with their families or on their hobbies and show that they are not always on in terms of work. Mm-hmm. They can talk about how they are preparing to manage their work so that they can take a vacation, and they hope that their team members are too. Mm-hmm. That kind of sharing about what's going on, I understand that it's stressful for you. I've had that kind of experience also. Tell me specifically what's going on with you. Because sometimes when a leader is trying to do that and trying to share, they may actually err too much on the side of their own sharing and the way that they do it. And that may actually shut the employee down. So the leader can open it up a little bit, but it shouldn't be about the leader.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And let's move a little bit into the situation when there is conflict, right? So even more so in this situation where you have a lot of remote teams, conflict might not be as evident as it was before, right? So a team member has an attitude, conflict has been caused. So how should a manager deal with such a person? What is your view on that?
Okay. I'm going to treat the person with an attitude a little separately from the conflict itself. Mm-hmm. Because when somebody has an attitude, and I'm going to take that to mean they don't behave in the way that we want them to, mm-hmm. they come across in some negative way, they seem resistant, they may not speak compassionately to other people. Is that a good mm-hmm. kind of set of examples? Okay. Yeah. So if that's what's going on, there are a couple of possibilities. I mean, our attitudes come from our behaviors and our beliefs about what's going on. So if somebody started out without an attitude, they started out positive and congenial and collaborative, and now they have an attitude, a leader should be concerned, what did we do to contribute to that? Did we do things in the workplace, or have I done things in the way I'm managing this person that have caused them to have these negative responses, because those kinds of responses come from negative feelings? Mm-hmm. Or are they suffering in some way in their personal lives? One of the things that is happening is sometimes in the flow of the work day when we were all together, a little negativity might not have been so noticeable if there were other positive people around, if there were other positive things happening. It may become more apparent, as you say now. And sometimes, because we're not with each other as much, little bits of conflict, no one may raise it as an issue because they don't want to make a big deal out of it. Mm-hmm. So There's this low level of conflict simmering underneath. It's harder to know it's there. And then all of a sudden, it may sort of shoot out. And that may be where you see the attitude. When someone's just had too much, or maybe they feel you're asking for too much change all at once, or there's some new project or priority and they're stressed. So, you know, it all comes down to the same basics. As with anything else, I wouldn't generally call somebody on negative behavior or attitude in a meeting, but after the meeting, I would follow up with them. And the first thing I'd ask them is, are they all right? Mm-hmm. Are you okay? Because in our last meeting, I noticed that when this thing happened, here's how you reacted. Mm-hmm. And either you didn't used to react that way, so I was concerned something wasn't okay, or you've been reacting that way more often. You seem more worried that things will not work well, or you seem more resistant to the new kinds of things we're trying to put in. And I'm concerned about, is there something in the way that I'm not aware of? Are there problems behind the scenes that we need to work on? Please tell me what's going on. And to open the conversation with open-ended general questions and to ask and then to wait. Mm-hmm. And actually give the person time to respond. And this is very hard, particularly on Zoom, to actually just wait and see what they have to say.
Yeah, because when we were in the office, so to say, then things are more compartmentalized. So you can basically, the questions you just asked, you know, is there something going on that I have not seen yet? Or is there something going on under the surface that you want to address, right? So these are all kind of work-related questions, either implicitly or explicitly. Now, in, let's call it our Zoom world, our remote world, and our online world, there can, of course, other reasons why that conflict has been simmering, right? It could be even a private situation, right? Or just not comfortable in how your office layout is that you need to work in your home or pot, whatever you're working, mm-hmm. right? So what are some questions that people can be asking to figure that out, where it's a little bit more on the, you know, on the hybrid side of where the conflict resides?
I think if you've built trust, those original conversation questions don't have to be just work-related. Mm-hmm. If you've got a good working relationship with someone, when you say, tell me what's going on, you seem more on edge than usual. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, they would already know that you care about them as a whole person. And theoretically, you should already know something about what their work environment is like, and possibly even where they're living and what that's been like for them, and whether there have been health issues. I would hope you would know some of that. And if you do, you could check specifically on something. Here's something that I've heard come up multiple times in the last, I'm going to say, year or so. And that's been pet deaths during this time. And it's partially in the normal course and partially, at least here in the States, people have been adopting rescue pets like nobody's business. And so some of these animals are not really healthy and they die, and people are wrecked by this. Yeah. So if you know that somebody has a pet that wasn't doing so well, ask about the dog. It is about work because we bring our whole selves wherever we go. We may not want to share all of that, but it's with us. And so if you know that somebody is stressed because their animal is not feeling well, or they're planning their son's wedding and they had to postpone it 3 times, whatever you know, you can use that as a bridge to say, how are things going with your family event? How is your elderly parent? The things that you know matter, those are like little stepping stones across this river of stress or negativity to show some human connection. But just saying, you know, you seem more on edge or tenser than you had a few weeks ago. Tell me a little about what's on your plate. Is it reasonable to be doing everything you're doing? Is there extra support you need? Are there tools you need? Are you getting the responses you need from other people in the organization? Tell me about what's happening in your work day. So you can bring it back to work, but you want to be clear that you actually want to know about what their experience is, what's really going on. They don't just have to give you some happy face thing of, oh, no, everything's fine. I just didn't sleep so well last night.
Mm-hmm. So with the number of leaders I've been coaching over the last 18 months, I noticed that there are more questions around passive defensive behavior, which basically means people are kind of growling, sobbing, or frustrated or unhappy, but they don't really bring it up. How things are going, I'm fine, you know, but you know, there was something there is not fine. So what are some ways to get behind that kind of, let's call it a subtle professional passive defensive behavior?
Yeah. So it really depends on how well you know the person and how much trust you've built in the past. So let me start with the assumption that we know each other well. I might say, I feel like there's something you're not telling me because I've seen you when you're upbeat and optimistic, and I'm seeing you now, and it's not the way you seem. So if it's personal and you don't want to tell me, that's fine. I hope you're working on it. I hope you know that if you want to talk about needing some time off or getting some support through our various, whatever our support channels are, I'm happy to talk about that. If it's about a work thing, though, and it affects the work, I'm counting on you to tell me. Because it's my job, actually, to make sure that you have what you need to get the work done and that there are not unnecessary things in your way. Mm-hmm. And so if there's something going on that it's appropriate for you to tell me because it's about the work, I really am counting on you. It doesn't have to be this minute. You may want to think about how you want to do it, but I'm going to ask you again. So think about how you could share with me what would make it better. You don't have to tell me every little bit about what's bothering you. I understand that. But I really want to know what would make a difference that would be helpful to you.
Actually, that's really very good. I love the way you put that and the way you articulate that. And there's quite a number of questions you can either use combined or dissected. And I've been working in North America, Europe, Asia, Middle East, Australia, everywhere. And that exact conversation that you just shared would really work everywhere. And I had the pleasure to coach actually it was a Cuban executive who was working in China for many years and many other places around the world. And he always says, hey, Will, if you treat people like people, it always works wherever you are. And I thought that's so well said. And that is exactly it, right? Yeah.
Could I add something to that, Will?
Yeah.
Because treating people like people doesn't always mean treating them the way you would want to be treated.
Yeah.
And many executives who are not as experienced in this kind of deeper human interaction, they want to do the right thing, and they think, how would I respond? Okay, let me work in that vein. And sometimes it doesn't work. And then they feel like they shouldn't reach out because it didn't work. But they don't really realize there are basic human things that are the same for all of us. Yeah. But we don't all have the same experiences, and we don't all have the same mindset. And so keeping it more open and expressing pretty explicitly that I care about what you care about because I care about you.
Yeah.
So tell it to me any way that works for you.
Mm.
I think that's really, really important. It's harder. It can make leaders very uncomfortable because they're afraid of emotional reactions. Mm. And it's particularly hard on Zoom. I mean, in an office, you can say, oh, let me get you some water while you put yourself back together, and then we'll talk about it some more. And you can actually walk away. But on Zoom, you can say, oh, do you want to take a minute, turn off your camera, or we can convene again, et cetera. But you don't know if they're going to come right back, you know?
Yeah.
It's hard. And the other thing that's hard, and this is different in different cultures, can you pat someone's shoulder? You know, sometimes just reaching out to someone makes a difference. Even not touching them, reaching across. One of the things that people can think about is actually leaning closer to the camera and even reaching out a little bit to show, I'm trying to be with you. I'm trying to bridge this gap.
Mm.
I mean, don't put your nose up to the camera, but no, within reason.
Yeah, but yeah, I sometimes kind of go closer, you know, I would also do it like that, you know, right?
So yes.
You can kind of even kind of funnily or jokingly do that. And it really works because people then feel, yeah, now we're having a normal conversation, right?
So. Oh, goodness, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. So, yeah, shifting a little bit the discussion to the kind of biases that people have and how it prevents people from kind of recognizing their performance, of which part of conflict can be because, you know, we need to sort something out. But part of conflict can also be like, yeah, somebody thinks they're a great performer, but they're not. And then that also creates, obviously, conflict. So how do you deal with that? And that kind of addresses this whole kind of Dunning-Kruger effect where there is this kind of cognitive bias and needs to be addressed anyway. So talk a little bit about that.
Okay. So thinking that you're doing better than you are, Dunning-Kruger, is just sort of like an added layer on top of the challenge of dealing with somebody who isn't doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And you are so right. Any kind of incompetence, lack of performance, underperformance, not working to potential, all of those kinds of things create messes inside the kinds of collaborations we need to do now. When your partner in the work is not giving what you need from them, that's a struggle. And then if they walk around saying they're doing great, that becomes offensive. And it feeds the conflict, right? It's bad enough if they're not any good, but if they're not any good and they tell everybody that the success is theirs, well, then I'm really aggravated and resentful. So these things, you know, they build on each other. It's so helpful to kind of pretend the conflict isn't there for a minute, suspend that, and to go back to the basics. What are the things we need to get accomplished? How are we accomplishing them? I try to stay away from why did this happen or why didn't that happen, which can sometimes impute motive. And when you're talking about motive, that then may characterize people as if they are good or bad. And that becomes offensive and puts fuel on the fire. So I try to stick to what is expected or what is happening and how did that happen or how can we go about it in a better way. Then it's much more concrete and about the work itself. Often, by peeling off the layers of, oh, what are the deliverables for the project? When are they due? Who is responsible for which pieces? By going back and revisiting these things, sometimes without even saying, John, what is this mess you made of this piece of the presentation? And, you know, why weren't you on your game? Without even going there, as you're discussing the situation, it becomes clear, oh, John, here's this piece that you haven't tackled yet. Please get to it. So you can be more neutral in that regard. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it turns out more than we would, I'm sure you've seen this 100 times, but it turns out more than we would think that people's expectations about how work should be done, those expectations don't match yours, mm-hmm. or they don't match the client's or the stakeholder, whoever it is. And so it is the responsibility of the leader or the coach for the leader, in effect, to be clear about the specifics of the expectations, which might be as simple as a presentation format, or that, oh, I don't know, this audience prefers a 2-page executive summary, whereas that audience, if you don't give them the whole report, they don't trust your summary. You know, just knowing and sharing the specifics. With someone who doesn't perform well, it can be very helpful to actually break the project assignment down into the specifics and review them concretely. Make sure you have agreement. So that's one kind of thing. A second kind of thing, though, is to look at the way when you have to correct how you would work on that. And there, too, it's a mix of explaining the correction. Maybe it's a writing style thing. We prefer this to sound more informal when we're writing these things. So we use contractions and we use exclamation points and we don't want it to sound dull. So we do these things. Please add some more of those. But you might also ask questions about, tell me how you came to decide that it should be this way. Because I was thinking it should be that way. So explain to me the choices you made, and we'll talk it through. And then I may ask you to redo it the way I was thinking, because that's the way we've been successful delivering it in the past. Mm-hmm. So actually taking apart their process, as opposed to just telling them it stinks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a number of angles to this, to kind of explore this a little bit. So one is what you're saying is make sure you agree on what success looks like, maybe kind of SMART goals or SMART objectives. This is what we need to end up with. So, and then clarify process. So let them explain, hey, what is the process you want to be using or are using? And you compare it with your process and you either agree on mine, yours, or a hybrid. And then, okay, we agreed mm-hmm. on success. Now go ahead. So that is one approach, which is great. Now, let's say in the recent past, when people are in the office, then it is much easier for me to see the input that they're putting into the process and the process, where they are in the process, because you can see how the work is progressing, right? But now in our remote world, that visibility is kind of gone, right? So it's like, where are we on this thing? Are they working on it, right? Is that process moving forward? Are we on speed? Yeah. And there's a number of angles to this. There is this kind of invisibility on how we're moving. There's mm-hmm. the challenge of there's a lot more input required at the moment to get things done than there was 18 months ago. So people feel like, yeah, I did a lot more work, but you know, it didn't work. Okay, well, it's still not good enough, right? So there's that input thinking versus output thinking. And then there's the being able to observe the process. And the third part is that, you know, in the office, we can talk about it. We can look at it together. There's a much more broader spectrum of communication because we can see, touch, and feel things and work things together. But in our current virtual world, we're having these conceptual ideas and we're throwing that through chats and through videos and half an email and maybe a Slack message or a WhatsApp message. So a lot of things get lost in the communication so how to deal with that? And I know this is a lot of things that I've said, but you know, so it's input, Yeah. It's clarity of process, where are we, status, and it's about communication channel. So what to do?
Okay. That is great because, you know, if you think of it as a big ball of string, it's big. It took a lot of time for it to get wrapped up the way it is now, and it's wrapped in multiple directions. So it's all there. That's great. What's that proverb about you should have, you know, if you didn't plant trees years ago, the best time is now. If you didn't work on trust and relationship in the past and the kind of parameters about here's how we work together, there's no time like now to start, to think about it and be conscious of it. That's a general statement. Let me give you some specifics. So you talked about the kind of lack of visibility we have today. Yeah. Well, we have lack of casual visibility. I can't walk down the hall and stick my head in your office, but we can have planned visibility as much as we need. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about how to do that and how to plan that, one of the things is to ask for it. And I'm going to say this from both the negative and also the positive. I don't know if you've had this experience yet. I do this with some clients. I do this with some colleagues. Sometimes it's great to get on some kind of video chat process, turn your sound off, and just work together so that you could interrupt to ask a question. You know your colleague is there. There is something called audience effect. We work better when we are in the presence of others. You know, it keeps us on track and on target. There are groups doing this internationally. So there are ways to substitute for the lack of physical proximity. Mm-hmm. That's important. And if you do that with regularity so it becomes the norm, that's great. Then you can trade ideas back and forth, et cetera. And you can be working in multiple channels at once because you might have your sound turned off and you might text your colleague or use Slack or, you know, whatever it is. But then you might also say, wait a second, we've gone back and forth on this three times. Would you please just turn your mic on and I'll turn on mine and let's hash this out. So you can escalate it as you need to. So that's one thing I was thinking. Another thing you made me think about was this kind of idea that because we're not as casually together, corrections may feel more onerous. Mm-hmm. When I edit your document and send it back to you, because I'm actually editing it instead of just talking to you about it, you may feel like, oh, she's making so many corrections. Why is that? So first of all, we could just do it by my talking to you about it. Or I might edit it and share it on screen and talk it through. You see where I did this thing? That's because of that, as opposed to just sending it to you and leaving you in the dark to sort it out yourself. But there's also another thing, which is checking. And in a way, this goes back to the case you were asking about before with the person who really doesn't know that their work is not good enough. And saying, so I changed this section and put it over here. And don't forget, we need to report on the ABC situation and et cetera, et cetera. You could ask at the end of the conversation. So I wanted to check, Will, because I think we went over this when we first talked about the project. So tell me, was I not clear that we would need X, Y, and Z? Because in my notes, I seem to have covered it. So tell me how I could do that better so it would be clear to you. And even I'm concerned because this is the third report where the parameters I laid out in the beginning were not fully met. So I want to talk about how we could break it down so it would be easier and more straightforward for you. Because one of the things that's really crucial when someone is not accomplishing the work successfully is not to overlook it. The first time, no big deal. And even the second time, and you know, pre-pandemic, mistakes are mistakes, and the second time you don't worry about it. But in my world, three is a pattern. And as soon as you have a pattern, if you don't address it, then it's on you. Then you have permitted that, and they become confident that what they are doing must be all right because you didn't raise it. So to find a way to raise it, of course, in as non-threatening and supportive a way as possible, is important. And then if you see no change, you really have to go into a kind of counseling mode. Mm-hmm. So that was a lot of stuff back in the answer.
Yeah. But I mean, two things that kind of really stood out to me as you were talking about this kind of implicit visibility that we have with proximity in the office, to kind of look over the shoulder thing so I can see what's going on. That's now not there. And now you have to make it more explicit and planned, right? So if you can't see it casually, then you have to plan to see it. So right. I like that idea. We just need to be more, create more planned visibility moments. Yeah. So I think I like that a lot. And then everything that's kind of informally happening, if it's not informally happening, then you need to kind of make it formally happening. Elsewhere, it just doesn't happen. And I liked what you said about, you know, just kind of put people on video and mute. We have a number of remote workers in some of our offices, and literally they are 8 hours a day on Zoom. They have their own Zoom station. They're carried around in the office. And if somebody needs them, you can just go to their tablet and just kind of tap on their tablet and say, hey, can we shortly talk? So they really feel connected, and they have visibility inside the office, what's going on. So they literally feel connected because, and nowadays that doesn't cost anything anymore, right? The tablet doesn't cost much, and a data connection costs even less, right? So it is very easy to do that, and it makes really a huge difference. So yeah, that's really good. So
I hope you go give those people downtime. Where they're allowed, you know, sure. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Yes. I just think my neck would hurt after a while. You know, we talked about burnout before. It's so funny. So when we're in the office, there's visibility and there's invisibility. If I'm on screen, I know you can see me and you're looking at me. If I'm in my office cubicle, workstation, whatever it is, I don't know if you're thinking about me. I feel less exposed in some ways. On screen, I can actually feel more exposed. And so it's very important to be explicit with those folks about rest now. This is your downtime. Shut that thing off. Mm. You know, please get a break from us. I worry about those folks burning out.
Well, so as we found, as long as these people are on a separate device, right? So they work on their computer, they do whatever they need to do, and their Zoom thing is just on a tablet on the side of their desk.
Uh-huh.
Right? So it's a little bit like in the office, right? Everybody sees you in the office, but you're not looking at people seeing you, right?
Yes.
So that is the same thing, right? So, but yeah, I got your point. At the same time, there's no obligation for people to be kind of
right.
On
particularly because if I'm on my tablet and you see me, I may not actually see you the way I would see you walking past in the office.
Yeah.
So it's that I don't know who's seeing me as much as I would in the office. It's an odd shift.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Let's talk a little about a little bit of a side subject that's kind of connected to this, the whole lizard listening that you refer to. So I think that's a really interesting point. So talk to us a little bit about that lizard listening and how can you train people to be better at, phrasing their thoughts so that communication becomes more effective.
So lizard listening is a term from my TEDx, and it referred to a kind of reductive, maybe not fully accurate, perception of our having a kind of reptilian brain and then a mammalian brain and then a kind of human brain, and different levels of function, and the reptilian part being about our response to threat, basically. Mm-hmm. And so when you are in lizard listening mode, all you're hearing is how things are going to affect you negatively. And will you lose something? Is something being taken away? Is someone challenging you? Are they trying to give you too much to do? All the different ways that it could be uncomfortable for you or frightening. And once you are in that mode, you're not really listening. You're trying to deal with the threat. So that's fight, flight, freeze, fold. All the things that are about detaching and not really taking in the rest of the message. And sometimes you can recognize when somebody goes into that mode. Have you ever been talking to somebody and it's almost like you can see them vacate the premises behind their eyes? Their face is there, but you know their spirit has gone somewhere else. Yeah. And you can almost see the hamster wheel in their brain running around, but it's like you're not real to them anymore. It's their own cascade of thoughts. So there are two different aspects to this. One is not to trigger that, to think about how will this person receive what I am going to say. And we all know an array of people who you can just say it straight out and they're okay, and you can even have a bad day and say it badly and they're okay, or they'll tell you, next time I'd like a little more care in how you delivered that, but okay, I get your point. And then there are people that you actually have to be more thoughtful and careful about if you are a caring leader. But sometimes we make a mistake and then we have to repair it. And when someone would come to me and say, I explained that he was going to have to do thus and so and et cetera, and he got all upset and angry, and I say, okay, tell me what you told him. And then we diagram that or break it out and look at, well, when you said, you know, we always do this thing this way, this way, this way. A person could have heard, we always do it this way. You didn't do it this way. There must be something wrong with you. What's the matter with you? And I dramatize more than I just did, even, so that the person delivering the awkward message starts to see, oh, it was straightforward in my head, but they might have really heard it differently. You want them to see what that experience would be like. If someone said to you this thing, what's the matter with you? Wouldn't you feel a little negative? So you try to put them a little bit in the situation so that they can at least do perspective taking and see why it might have had a negative effect. And then you say, so what else do you need to communicate? And you take it the way they think it, and you rebuild it to be more of a curious, open question, the way we were talking about before, than a closed, negative question. So that's one kind of thing. The second thing is that we are all prone to this. We have different, you know, it's like that idea about somebody pushing your buttons. We all have different buttons, but we all have them. Mm-hmm. So when you see that somebody is starting to react badly, they may be physically pulling away. Even on Zoom, you can see this. Somebody sort of starts to lean back or moves their chair. It's very hard to see on Zoom the thing about somebody going away behind their eyes. So you have to know them well. But ask them to come back. Say, I see that Something about that didn't sit well with you. You kind of pulled away. Now is a great time, if you haven't done it before, to be teaching everybody techniques for grounding themselves, for re-anchoring to their breath and to sensory perceptions. I'm going to show you, this is a wonderful, crazy technique. When you're dealing with somebody and they're really stressed, say, turn around and look over your shoulder. I'm gonna do it. Mm-hmm. And they turn around and say, okay, now turn the other way. Okay. And if they just sort of look, you say, no, really, turn all the way around and look. Is anything chasing you? When we actually look behind us, mm-hmm. it tells the brain that there's nothing bad behind us. And oddly, we start to calm. Mm-hmm. So there are so many of these strange neuro-related techniques that calm the brain. One of the best ones, so fast, ask someone to lengthen their out-breath. That calms the vagus nerve. I'm not going to go into the whole mechanism of why this works, but it's the parasympathetic nervous system. The longer out-breath, if you were running away from the tiger in the jungle, you don't have time for a longer out-breath. Your brain knows you are in deep danger. If you have the time to lengthen your out-breath, you must actually be safe. So let the whole system calm down. Mm-hmm. Or going through, tell me three things that you see and three things you can touch and three things you hear. And there are a variety of techniques for re-anchoring yourself mm-hmm. and others. And when any situation gets out of hand or you feel people aren't getting your message, or you can say, I need a break. I need to re-anchor. Let me reset. I'm going to do it. You want to do it with me? Here's what we're going to do. And give them a breathing practice. Give them, you know, a sensory practice, any of that. Let everybody work together on being calm.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One of the things I learned is that if I evaluate the way I talk to other people, and many times I think, yeah, I don't want people to talk to me the way I talk to other people, right? So it's kind of really kind of like evaluate, you know, if somebody would be talking to you the way you talk to them, would that be what you enjoy, right? And many times when I'm coaching leaders and they say, you know, my boss is such a terrible person, a challenging person because, and then they explain the whole thing why, then I'm thinking, yeah, but that's exactly the way you work too, right? So the basic what you're telling me is that you don't like to be treated the way you treat other people, right?
Like, right.
Interesting way people are wired. Yeah.
You know what else is funny? Ask them if they know what their bad face looks like.
Yeah.
We all have one. I mean, we all have multiple, but we all have one that really we use when we don't like what someone's saying to us or we don't trust them.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting for people to realize they have that when they didn't know it.
Yeah. I had the not so great pleasure to do a number of webinars in front of mirrors when you were traveling in a hotel room. Sometimes, but that's such a scary experience. Yeah,
it's true. It's terrible.
Yeah. But yeah, there's also a lot more tension, right? Because behind Zooms or online meetings, there's a lot more tension in the way we kind of perform, so to say, whereas if you're in a meeting, then you can just kind of let your hair down or you're much more less on guard. So yeah, there's a lot of that too. Yeah, good. So last but not least, question I want to touch on. So any advice that you'd like to share on kind of how to not put a problem on the table? I know you have been doing a number of publications around this, so tell us where we should go and find that.
Yeah. Okay. So how not to put a problem on the table. Yes. So I'll give you just a couple of quick things about that. Yeah. Try to avoid the words always and never. You always make this mistake, or you never do it the way I want it. These are good at home too. Always and never characterize the other person as being irredeemable. You know, this will never work. Well, right away, I might as well just shut down. Why would I want to deal with you at all? So that's a very small example. Another way is to, in effect, say, here's a problem. What are you going to do about it? As if it has nothing to do with me. I'm completely neutral in this situation. I'm shoving it across the table at you. And then it's very legitimate to say, I see that you just put a problem on the table and shoved it across the table to me. Well, I'm going to put it back in the middle of the table and let's open it and unwrap it a little and see what's really going on and see if we can help each other take it apart. Remember that you need the other person's help, even if they are the one in authority and they are responsible, or if you're the one in authority and you have the power to command them in some ways. You can't command someone to be helpful. They have to choose that. So you have to invite. Let's see. What are other bad ways to put a problem on the table? So here's a very bad one. This has been going on for a long time, and it's time you knew about it. Well, why haven't you told me all the times in the past? So there are many bad ways. I want to give you a reverse situation, though. A number of years ago, it became almost fashionable for leaders to say, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. Have you had that experience? Okay, that's a horror show. If they had the solution, they wouldn't be bringing you the problem. So the first thing is, I mean, sometimes they do have solutions and they just need authority. That's usually very easy to deal with. You know, you ask for cost benefit or you make the case, go. But when they bring you a problem, it's because they need you in some way, whether they don't know how to figure it out or they don't know how to tell their colleagues what to do or whatever it is. So announcing that it is their responsibility to bring the solutions is a way of shutting them down and making them not tell you about problems you need to know about. So if that has been your tendency, please start saying things like, okay, you've brought me the problem. Now tell me what your ideas are about it. Open it again. And you said I write about this all the time, and I do. Sometimes I feel like I say the same thing over and over and over, just in different language, you know. But on my website, I have hundreds, really hundreds, by now it may be 1,000, I don't know, of blogs and articles about how you take situations apart so that it becomes mutually advantageous to work on it and you eliminate the kind of dumping of a problem. Oh, and that reminds me of one other kind. If you're the boss, please don't do what I call swooping and pooping. And that means that you leave the person alone and then you decide something is terrible and you dive in and you say, well, this is not right. And you leave. And that can ruin a person's whole day to the point where they don't want to get any work done at all, or they can't think of what to do. You know, you never say anything positive. You just show up when it's bad and you leave them holding the mess. So this kind of, let's see how we can work on this together approach softens the thing and gives people back their brain power.
So if people want to read up on this a little more specifically, then your publication around why is there so much conflict at work and what can you do to fix it addresses this. Is that right?
So that's my TEDx. I have an ebook on my website that's about the interpersonal aspects of conflict. The TEDx talks more about the structural aspects of conflict and dealing with those. But the ebook is actually more about the interpersonal dynamics and conversational gambits. And so the two things kind of are bookends for each other.
Yeah. All right. So what's the title of the ebook so that people can go there and just find it easily?
Oh, goodness. I don't even know. If you go to my website, on the homepage, there's a big button where you can get it.
Okay, good. Then we'll also include that in our video down here regarding itself.
That's great. Thank you.
Liz, thank you so much for our conversation. Very illustrative, very colorful, very clear on what to do and what not to do and how people can do specific things to help themselves and help their team, especially in a world where care for each other is not only so much more necessary, but also so much more wanted and so much more important to do this. And this is not just in the current season, but in moving forward, this will remain to be the case. So yeah, this was very valuable, very useful, and very well illustrated. Thank you very much for taking your time and look forward to stay in touch on many other things down the road.
Thank you. Well, it was such a wide-ranging conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.